Some of them haunt the halls of Parliament House. Quite a few of them run off to the Big Apple. You often find them lurking on Twitter. They're the ghosts of Prime Ministers past.
I, Kevin Michael Rudd.
I, Julia Eileen Gillard.
I, Anthony John Abbott.
I, Malcolm Blight Turnbull. You swear that I will well and truly serve
the Commonwealth of Australia.
Her Majesty, Queen Elizabeth II.
The Queen of Australia, so help me God.
Former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd is still haunted by the events of 2010. This week, he lashed out at the media and his former colleagues as he launched his new book, The PM Years.
Look, it's not fun to go through your own decapitation. It's a visceral experience.
With both Rudd and Julia Gillard coincidentally in Canberra this week, Turnbull's belated return to Sydney from licking his wounds in New York, and the ever-present spectre of Tony Abbott on the coalition backbench. It's a good time to ask, what role should former Prime Ministers play in our politics? From the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Please Explain. I'm Tori Maguire. Later, we'll speak to Chief Political Correspondent David Crowe about the impacts of a hung parliament in the wake of Wentworth and how much harder it will be for Scott Morrison to govern now he's lost his majority in the House of Reps. But first, Peter Harcher, this week you wrote that every Prime Minister post John Howard has left office blaming the media, at least partly for their downfall. Is this instability all your fault?
Yes, I plead guilty. It's such an obvious solution as soon as you say it. We thought we had all these, you know, deep problems with the political parties and their ambitions and their agendas. It turns out it's just me. Just yes. Get rid of me and I'm sure everything will be fine.
We'll just lock you in a room and we'll have stability again.
That's right. The point that I was responding to was Kevin Rudd's point about how it was an article of mine that was seized upon by the Gillard forces to mount her attack on Rudd's prime ministership. And it's true that the media can have an enormously disruptive effect, but the key point is that it's not the media doing it in isolation. I was reporting facts that were actually going on. We can't be disruptive unless the political players themselves want to be disruptive. And that's what that was an outgrowth of.
So as a society, we seem to have created this weird social experiment where we have this high turnover of aggrieved leaders that we set off into the wild. And then we're shocked when they seem bitter and want revenge.
Yes, it's kind of strange failure of human understanding or human empathy, perhaps, about what you're doing to a prime minister when you ignominiously, prematurely tear them down in the middle of their first term. First, it's just basic, you know, human pride, human dignity, and human self-worth. There's a deeper thing too, and it's about the nature of the prime ministership and the nature of power. Power takes a very, very strong grip on leaders, especially at that level, which is the highest level that we have. There's a reason that more than 20 countries in the world have term limits on their national leaders, and that is once they get into power, it can be very, very difficult to get them out, and because it has an addictive quality. You know, there's even research that shows with primates, gorilla, a male older one that's leading a tribe dies, and there's no one ready to, none of the other silverback male gorillas are ready to step into his shoes, so to speak, that a younger, immature male will step in and become leader. And he then becomes prematurely silverbacked because they only grow the silverback when they're mature adults. So it actually changes the physiology of the creature. And the supposition is that you could extend that if we could somehow measure it and see the influence, that it's the influence on humans is also incredibly powerful. So you are doing a very, very powerful thing when you elect somebody like to that position, and you're doing the influence on humans is also incredibly powerful. So you are doing a very, very powerful thing when you elect somebody, and you're doing an incredibly powerful world of damage when you remove them prematurely.
And for a lot of these people too, Peter, it's the first time they've ever had a real failure, and it's really public and really humiliating.
To have it done so publicly, to have all of the entrails to be publicly examined, to have your enemies rejoicing and dancing on your grave, so to speak, and to have it the full glare of publicity, and not just your own country, but internationally, people see this stuff too. It's a particular kind of humiliation that produces a particular kind of anger. And the most obvious ones were in Kevin Rudd and Tony Abbott. you saw that burning, visceral anger that just took hold in them, and it was not going to relax its grip until they'd found their vengeance.
So we've got no shortage of ex-prime ministers who have burning vengeance on their minds to examine. So I thought we might just work backwards. Let's start with Malcolm Turnbull. There are many people in the Liberal Party this week filled with white-hot rage that Malcolm Turnbull did not assist Dave Sharma in his campaigning for the seat of Wentworth. Do you think that's fair?
No, I don't. And in fact, I love the line by Nick Bryant, the former BBC correspondent in Australia, who said that that was like stabbing Malcolm Turnbull in the back and then blaming him for bleeding on the carpet. Turnbull had always signalled that if turned out of the prime ministership by one means or another, he would immediately leave the parliament. He'd been sitting there for years. It was well known. You could make a case that he should have changed his position and stuck around for the good of the party, but the other angle, the Turnbull view, is that he was simply keeping his word to himself, his electorate, and to his party. And for him to have been torn down in it's a coup that still has no justification. The new prime minister still has not managed to explain why he's the new prime minister and why Turnbull had to be torn down. And that's why Labor makes it the first question in every day's question time, to keep the pressure up and to expose the existential question at the heart of this prime ministership. Why is he there? So to do all that without any, palatable or credible public explanation, and then expect Malcolm to turn around, break his promise to himself and to his electorate, and then stick around to help, is just unrealistic.
When he did lose his job, Tony Abbott said that, there will be no sniping. That turned out to be a false promise. Would it have been better for him as a human being and for the Liberal Party for him to actually leave Parliament and go and do something else?
He did think about leaving, and there was a phase where he was exploring possibility of jobs in the private sector, but it just didn't materialise for him. So it was an option that didn't work. So I guess in the end, he stuck around because he was out of other options. For Tony Abbott's state of mind, he certainly seemed very angry, and he seems much vindicated now that vengeance has been delivered.
So speaking of anger, Kevin Rudd, he stood up yesterday at his book launch in Canberra and said that while all the sniping about him had taken place, he had just kept his mouth shut, which made everyone chuckle. He's now written an enormous book that dumps on almost everyone, doesn't it?
Most of it is telling in a fairly positive light the story of his own government, and it's quite entertaining. But he can't resist the urge to settle some very old scores. The principal target, of course, is Julia Gillard, but there are others. One exception, though, he was very gentle with his handling of Bill Shorten. We know that they don't really have a great deal of respect for each other, and we know that Kevin Rudd would much prefer to see Anthony Albanese as the leader of the Labor Party. But there's barely a breath of criticism of Bill Shorten in the book, and I think probably it's a prudent step by Kevin wanting to first keep his relationship with the future Labor leader intact, and second, perhaps not be labelled an even bigger Labor rat than some of his colleagues like to call him already.
So how have things turned out for him? Obviously, he must have been bitterly disappointed when his UN dreams were shattered. What's he doing now, and how's his level of anger?
So we now have a series of prime ministers who've been torn down by their colleagues prematurely, but only one of them has then suffered the further humiliation of having his country veto his next career choice, which was the UN Secretary General's job. The Turnbull government, having first endorsed Rudd's bid, as you would, because this isn't about politics, this is about your country and getting a voice at the highest levels in the world. Turnbull then, because of criticism from his own people, vetoed Rudd's candidacy. So there was a particular double humiliation to Kevin Rudd, losing the prime ministership, then being vetoed by his own country. I think that probably helps explain some of the lingering anger.
Moving on to Julia Gillard, it's amazing that this week that she and Kevin Rudd were both in Canberra. I assume they didn't cross paths. I assume that their staff made sure that they didn't run into each other. She was there for two reasons. One was for the apology to the children who had been abused in institutional care. And she was there because she was the one who called the Royal Commission that unearthed all these accusations. And she got an amazing reception in Parliament on Monday. And later in the week, her new portrait was unveiled. What's her post-Prime Ministership experience been like in contrast to Kevin Rudd's?
Well, the portrait itself that was unveiled in Parliament, her parliamentary official portrait, provides a bit of the answer to that, I think, Tori. It's a beaming, sort of serenely smiling and gently glowing portrait of Julia Gillard that is now going to hang on the wall in Parliament House. And I think that reflects the state of her post-prime ministerial conduct. She has been, of all the prime ministers who in this most recent generation have been brought down by their colleagues in internal coups, she is the one who seems to have accepted it with the most equanimity and been the most philosophical, and the one who has been able to get on with her life without needing to keep returning to settle old scores.
I wonder what it is about her that has allowed her to do that and not sit and dwell in all the pain and darkness for so long after it was over.
I don't have a comprehensive answer. All I would observe is that, as far as I'm aware, the experiment with the silverback gorillas was only applied to male silverback gorillas.
So looking at the four of them, what's your assessment about which one of them has been the least able to cope in the wake of their untimely end and perhaps has been the most damaging to the parliament and to politics?
That's quite a competition, isn't it?
Mm.
So let's put Gillard as the most accepting, philosophical and dignified, credit to Julia Gillard. Kevin Rudd said to me in an interview, which we ran in the Good Weekend last weekend, that it had been a very hard and difficult recovery for him to emerge from those two humiliations. The quote he said was, without family and faith, I don't know that I could have come through it as a complete human being. He didn't want to elaborate, but I think we are left to imagine the sort of psychological blow that he would have gone through. We saw his anger reflected all the way through until this very week with the publication of that book, where he says, for example, Labour frontbencher Jason Clare has a PhD in treachery, that Wayne Swan, he says, was incompetent, out of his depth, utterly bungled the mining tax and so on and so forth. Then Tony Abbott, I think, would be on a similar par of on the uneasy, unquiet ghosts. Malcolm Turnbull, well, he lost the opposition leadership, but we've yet to see how he's going to cope with losing the prime ministership, except to say that he's left the parliament. He remains angry. I think that's pretty clear to anybody who's spoken to him in recent days. He keeps it in check. He outwardly is very well-mannered as ever. But he is angry.
He went through some pretty dark times when he lost the opposition leadership, didn't he? I mean, it was probably quite sensible that Lucy whisked him off to New York as soon as she could, as soon as he got out of the parliament.
Yeah, he did. And we also know that he took it pretty hard when he lost the opposition leader's job too. And he said after that, after a while, that he was going to leave parliament, leave politics altogether. In that period, and we know this thanks to Kevin Rudd's book, he met with Kevin Rudd, and Rudd writes in his book that Turnbull was depressed, was very down. And that's when Rudd then offered him the position of an envoy for Australia, a climate change envoy to serve the federal government, which Malcolm didn't take up. If it's hard losing the opposition leader's job, it's got to be on an entirely different plane losing the prime ministership. And I'm sure you're right, it was a good idea to get him out of town, but still, his colleagues say that he was on the phone every day.
Do you see any hope for us getting out of this cycle of building up these people with a certain type of personality and drive and then cutting them down and then setting them loose and wondering why they can't behave themselves?
You'd think both major parties would have learned, especially the Liberal Party, because they got to sit back and watch it happen first in the Labor Party with Rudd Gillard Rudd. And you would have thought they would have seen the pattern and the enormous damage that flowed, but they didn't. They've now lived out exactly the same scenario. It's mind-boggling in its cloth-eared, thick-headed stupidity, you know. So some advocate, and that's what Kevin Rudd has been making news with this week, his call for the Liberals to change the rules for how leaders are chosen and elected, much as he changed the rules for the Labor Party as his parting gift to Labor. That, I think that is a part of the answer, because it puts some sort of road bump, at least, in the face of a juggernaut of parliamentary self-indulgence that might want to express itself as a leadership challenge. It's not a complete solution. It's a partial solution. The full effect is really for the parties, for their members, to develop some maturity, to develop some self-restraint, to realise they're not there for their own self-aggrandisement, their factional pleasures. They're there to serve the party and the people in the largest sense, and just use some maturity and some self-restraint.
Peter, thanks so much.
Hi, I'm Lisa Davies, editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. The Herald and Age newsrooms are home to some of the country's most experienced journalists, delivering trusted news and analysis every day. But we can't do it without you. Our subscribers get unlimited access to our award-winning independent journalism, plus exclusive behind-the-scenes stories you can't get anywhere else. Subscribe today and support news you can trust.
The voters of Wentworth were out to punish the Coalition at last week's by-election for knifing their local member Malcolm Turnbull. And punish they did, with the biggest swing away from a government in by-election history and a victory for local independent Karen Phelps. The Morrison-led Coalition now holds just 75 of the 150 seats in the House of Representatives. Chief political correspondent David Crowe, what does this mean?
They've got a real problem now, Tory, in the House of Representatives. We've become accustomed over recent years to governments having real struggles in the Senate getting their legislation through. Now we're going to see some of those same problems emerge in the House of Representatives, where there are now questions over how much of the government's agenda they'll actually be able to get through. Now, of course, in a situation like this, where they only have 75 out of 150 seats in the lower house, they're now into the realms of a hung parliament because it's on a knife edge. They've got to choose, well, they have chosen one of their 75 members in the lower house to sit in the speaker's chair. That's Tony Smith. That leaves them 74 MPs on the floor of the chamber. So they don't have an absolute majority on the floor of the chamber for anything ranging from a procedural vote to actual legislation. It's true that the Speaker has a casting vote, but that would rarely be used. It could be used if there's a vote of no confidence in the government. We could see a situation where the Liberal MP who's in the Speaker's chair could have a casting vote on that. But in terms of day-to-day running of the Parliament, it's really going to be the 74 government votes on the floor that are going to count, and they're going to need some backup from members of the crossbench.
So tell me about the crossbench. They're a bit of a motley crew. For any given piece of legislation, the government is going to need how many of them to be on board?
It would need at least two members of the crossbench to get legislation through in the lower house. At the moment, they're hoping that they can rely on Bob Katter, the Queensland Independent, and that they can also rely on Cathy McGowan from Northern Victoria, the seat of Indi, who has indicated in the past and in recent days that she would still support the government on issues of supply and confidence. That is, confidence that the government can hold government and supply on crucial budget bills. That does not bind her in any way in terms of her future decisions. And it doesn't mean that they can count on her vote on legislation, including, you know, changes to budget settings or tax measures.
So what are the big bills that the Morrison government would be looking to get through the parliament before the next election that now it's going to be harder for them to do?
At the moment, there's really one clear candidate, and that's the energy package that Scott Morrison and the Energy Minister, Angus Taylor, outlined this week. And that's where I think we're going to see some very interesting dynamics play out, because it's not clear to me that the government's going to be able to get everything it wants with that energy package. And if they don't get some of that legislated, then they don't actually have what they call the big stick to force energy companies to act on price. Now, I don't think there's any objection to parts of that package, like the default price idea, which reduces prices for households. But there's a lot of controversy about other parts of the energy package, including the idea of underwriting new power generation projects that could include coal-fired power stations. They're going to need a vote in the lower house on that idea. They're going to need a vote in the Senate. And getting that through both chambers will not be easy.
So Julia Gillard presided over minority government, and she got a lot of legislation through and is sort of widely regarded as probably a better negotiator than a better retail politician. Is Scott Morrison going to have to change his style while he's trying to make the case for the government over the next couple of months, but also trying to wrangle the crossbench?
No, I don't think that's going to be the issue for Scott Morrison, because we've only got a few months before the next election, and it won't be long before he's in full campaign mode early next year. And at that point, it doesn't matter whether the legislation goes through Parliament or not. It's a matter of a contrast in terms of what he's putting forward and what Bill Shorten is putting forward at the next election. So we're getting towards a point in this Parliament where the passage of the legislation, other than that energy package that I mentioned, becomes largely theoretical. It's about sharpening the choices between the two major parties. And I think that's the difference with the Gillard government, because the stats that you cited from the Gillard government were very much about that full three-year term. Of course, some of the things that they did legislate were repealed later anyway, notably the carbon tax. I think the benchmark's different for Scott Morrison now that he's got the next couple of months to run.
So what are the Labor Party going to do here? It would be tempting for them to be a destabilising force and to potentially force the end of the Morrison government early, but there's not really much in that for them, is there?
There's some real timing problems with that scenario. There is something in it for them in the sense that if they're confident that they can win, that they can force an election, and they would, in their minds, get to the government benches as soon as possible. But we're just about to go into a Victorian state election campaign, and we've still got the New South Wales state election campaign early in 2019. The window of opportunity for a federal poll is difficult. I think that a date after the state election early in 2019 is still the most likely, and I think the government would still rather go to May 2019. If Labor were to force something to come on earlier, if it's in the middle of school holidays, if it's in the middle of the summer holidays, I don't think Labor would want to be bearing responsibility for that. And so I think there are some reasons why they would not want to be seen to be destabilising to the point of forcing an election right now.
So just finally, what do you think would have been more concerning for Scott Morrison and his colleagues about the result of Wentworth? Would it have been the fact that they lost the majority, or would it have been the absolutely belting swing against the government?
I think it's the belting swing. I think that there are strong views on the government that they can get through this with the support of the independents. But I think that swing that we're seeing, 19% or so, we haven't got the final vote, that is a shocker. And it is historic. There was a by-election swing against the Labor government in the Wills by-election that was bigger than this. But that result was invalidated because of constitutional rules, Section 44 again. This time, it's a valid result so far, and it's a real belter. And that's a danger sign for the government. We're seeing this debate within the Liberals about, is Wentworth really an indicator about what the rest of Australia thinks and feels? Well, the fact that they're having that debate means that they just don't know where their base is at. They've lost this base in Wentworth. Now they're struggling with whether that really matters for them with their base in other parts of the country, parts of the country like Queensland, where success is so vital for the Nats. That's a real problem for them to deal with as they try to appeal to a group which, to be honest, is a diverse base. And they've got to keep people satisfied not just on lower electricity prices, but on things like reducing carbon emissions, because some of their base wants action on that. The Wentworth by-election result has highlighted this immense challenge for them.
David, it'll be a very interesting few months. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Tori.
Thanks to my guests this week, Peter Hartcher and David Crowe. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. Support the work we do. Our subscribers get unlimited access to award-winning, independent journalism, plus exclusive behind-the-scenes stories you can't get anywhere else. Follow the link in our show bio to subscribe today. This episode was produced by David Escort and Declan Bowring. Technical assistance from David McMillan and Cormac Lally. And Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori Maguire. Thanks for listening.